I'd like to welcome everyone this evening. So we're going to journey again further into this Satipatthana Sutta. But I'd like to preface what I want to speak about with a couple of things. One is that there's a constant refrain that the Buddha uses to sort of summarize every so often the sutta. He talks about all of this is meant to allow the person to abide independently of all things. Independently of all things. And what he's doing is casting the sutta to bridge freedom, really. It's about being free and independent. But may I say that from the wrong perspective, we can misread what it means to be independent of all things, especially as Westerners. We like the cowboy and cowgirl approach to our meditation and sort of the self-reliant and nobody's going to tell me what to do approach to our meditation. And that's really not what the Buddha is pointing at here. In fact, may I say, to abide independently of all things is the same as abiding interconnected to all things. Lest we believe ourselves to be forming a stronger and more resolute and defined sense of self, it's that very project that has to diminish in order for that interconnection to be known. So as he talks about abiding independently of all things, it just simply means that there's no dialogue or our narrative we're having with life in form of any kind or attempt to resist it at all. And in the absence of that dialogue, in the absence of resistance, there is a rising of the interdependent quality of life. Now, unless we understand the continuum that we're walking on is going from noise, the noisiness of our thinking and the noisiness of our resistance and the sense of objection we have to in commentary that we give to most experiences, we're not going to realize that that journey from noise to stillness is also the journey that he's talking about to abide independently of all things. So it's very important for us to compare notes here so that we're not thinking that there are two things that are being, two invitations that are being extended. Now, I also want to talk just a little bit about the sutta up until this point, because we haven't actually gone through much of it at all, despite the fact that we've done like 12 talks or something. And I'm deliberately going slowly, obviously, because I don't think, what are we rushing for? You know, what's the next subject going to be? If it isn't covered in this one, it probably isn't worth speaking about. But the sutta started off by welcoming us into our bodies. And many of us have a relationship to our bodies that we have gone into, and we don't feel welcomed when we come home. We don't feel like this is a home base that provides any sense of settledness or comfort or calm at all. In fact, we may have had a traumatic history with it or whatever, and we're a little bit edgy in relationship to our own body. So that has to be solved. We have to be able to bring ourselves into our body and find that settledness there, which means that we have to go through and endure and release some of the painful memories and conditioning that's associated with it. So that's part of the welcoming ceremony that we do. And then the other invitation that I find throughout this sutta up until now has been an exploration of the body, what it is. What is the body? And at times he will encourage us to explore it quietly. He'll say, don't use memory and previous knowledge of what the body is in your exploration of what it is in this moment. And so he's cutting off the past images we have associated with the body through that exploration. And what you find is that as we quiet ourselves and investigate what the body is without a narrative telling us that we are now at our little digit, the end digit of our little finger on our left hand, suddenly the body becomes very wondrous, very large, very unformed, yet very safe within that unformed quality. And we can just deal with the sensation of the body as it is, rather than as connecting it to a personal relationship, a personal form, a personal project that we have with our body. Now, I don't know how many of you have done courses with Goenka or his trainees, but the Goenka courses take you through the body systematically, like a plane of sensation, where you start at your head and move your attention throughout the physical body over and over again. It's called sweeping meditation. And as one begins to sweep one's awareness through the body, what the body begins to feel like is an energetic system rather than a physical system. And you can feel the movement of those waves of energy moving down. It's a very good practice, and I encourage people who haven't done it to do it if you want to do a 10-day course, but there's no walking associated with this particular tradition, and a philosophy of exclusivity that doesn't really encourage sitting with groups that aren't practicing that form. So that if you leave the philosophy behind, the practice itself is a good one, and it shows you a different relationship to the body than a body of bones and sinews and other muscles and all the other tissue elements that we're going to be going in tonight. So the Buddha is encouraging a systematic exploration of the body. He's giving several different techniques and exercises to do just that. And he, at the same time, he's giving these very historically well-conditioned exercises. There's also an implied meaning to this sutta that I think most people miss. It's not just what is stated. I think of any sutta that the Buddha gave, because after he gave it, it had to be condensed down, because then it could be communicated and rememorized and passed along. So it was like, okay, we've got to take all the water out of this. It's like a Stuffit expander, which I've talked about. You know, you download a huge file, and then you put stuff in expander, and explodes out and becomes very rich. Well, this data, these suttas haven't been exploded or haven't been elaborated upon. They stay very condensed in themselves. And what can be helpful is not to look just at the strict meaning and definition of translation of what every word is and every sentence means, but to bring some water into this thing, to hydrate it a little bit so that it begins to tell us more of its richness, which I'm sure was much more elaborate when the actual discourse was given than it is today. And so my suggestion is to look for the implications of this sutta. And we'll be going through some of the ones today. But just to review some of the ways that up until this point there have been implied messages within what we have read. He's talked about, for instance, when you start moving, that there is no action that is outside of one's ability to discern and be aware of that movement. And he goes through a whole list of different movements that he encourages us to be fully aware of. So an implication of that is that he's no longer separating. He's not keeping us on the cushion. He's taking us right into life, in the full embodiment of life. And therefore, he's saying what's implied in that is that there is no difference between the secular and the spiritual divisions in this world. That the spiritual and the secular are one and the same. Now, we should understand that, because as long as we have a divide in our minds, a division in which we think this is a spiritual activity and this is a secular one, they'll never come together in the rich flowering that is meant in this sutta. So let's turn off our phones, for God's sake. We've been through this every single week. Okay. Another is in terms of control and surrender. We find that as we turn over our attention to full awareness, we lose the ability to control the Dharma, to make it operate under our capacity and effort. And so we have to just open this whole thing up so that it comes back in on its own way, in its own disposition. We can't keep certain things out and want certain things or certain messages and look. It's a full embrace of the entire range and examination of life as life is presenting it, not as we wish it to be presented. And that's a tremendous help, because we're always trying to kind of arrange our Dharma life and our worldly life so that it's all very systematic and controlled and orderly and, you know, predictable and all set up for us. But that's essentially, we're unable to do that. And the Buddha, I think, is implying that we shouldn't be doing that, that we should just let the full catastrophe of life explode forth. So ultimately, he's also speaking about, he keeps talking about full alertness, fully alert, and fully alert is the willingness to release our tendencies to control our awareness so that it's just selecting out what we want to be alert of. I'll pay attention just to my breath this time, but not to my back pain. I'll pay attention just to the sounds, but I'll eliminate all the other distracting sensations. This full alertness, this full abiding, has no selectivity to it. And I think what he's ultimately doing is moving us from a very controlled form of mindfulness meditation to a full abiding presence in life. So these are just some of the ways that up until this point, I think that he's been moving us and implying that the practice unfolds. But let's continue on here. And before I get to this next section, which is a more difficult section, I want to just encourage us to look at the body in context to the universe. And I do this to lighten up what is about to come, I think. And remembering that the same intelligence of the universe is also contained in the body. And I've been following a series of lectures on cosmology that I have appreciated a great deal. Well, the one lecture that is most recently in mind is in regards to the first second of the universe. Essentially, in the first second after the hot Big Bang unfolded, the laws of physics became manifested as we know them today. And all the particles of life, all the materiality of life began also to manifest. And one would have to ask, out of nothing came that something. Where did that something arise from in the universe? Since it came from nothing, in the beginning there was nothing. And the way this cosmologist answers that is he says that as energy comes into the vacuum of space, it produces the particles of materiality of space. And how does the vacuum then, and this is the cosmologist speaking, not me, he says, how does the vacuum know what to produce? How does it know whether to produce a proton and an antiproton and not two protons or whatever the combination of activity is in there? How does the energy convert itself into the matter? And he says, that knowing, he says, the vacuum gives life to the universe and informs it how to behave. It comes from the emptiness itself. Well, I find that to be interesting. The knowledge to do that is located within every point in space, he says. The vacuum gives life to the universe and informs it how to behave. Okay, so we are a part of that. We're a part of that. We're a part of the vacuum of space. And we have been formed out of it. And that knowledge is located within every point of space, meaning every point of us as well. And so the intelligence that we find in the body is really the intelligence we find in the universe. We shouldn't think of it as two separate things. Something that scientists seem to omit or discourage an explanation for this is consciousness. That consciousness, this vacuum, was not without consciousness. Consciousness couldn't be measured, but consciousness was the informing quality, was the creative quality of that. That consciousness, that is all of life, is also an intimate part of each of our individuated lives. And so as we begin to explore the body, it's from that alignment that we should begin to assert that we should begin to line ourselves up, not through the individuation that we have associated ourselves with, but with the expanse, with the infinite that is so relevant and is so accessible, really, as we do some of these practices. I say they're relevant, I say they're accessible. They're only relevant and accessible if we don't keep bridging everything we see with the discourse and label that we give to it. When we take the name and the word away from what it is that we actually experience, it stretches out, it becomes expansive, it becomes infinite, you might say. So we're about ready to move into the unbeautiful quality of the body. It's called in Buddhism asobha. Asobha means beautiful. Asobha means without beauty. And we are going to play with the theme of repulsion now. Now, we're just playing with a perception. And I'll talk about why it is that this was relevant or is relevant to many of us. What's the point of it? Are we negating the body? Are we, going into ascetic practices here? I don't think so. But remember how much attraction we invest in the body, how much we have at stake in this thing, how we beautify it, how our pages of our magazine are so filled with the glamour of the body, which is a perception of the body. It's not the whole story. But we have leaned so heavily within that perception that most of us find that we try to bridge our own appearance with the appearances of those magazines because we feel that the attractive quality of the body is the most acceptable and the most encouraged within this culture. So the Buddha doesn't want us to lean. So he's going to be talking about some of the repelling qualities, the repulsing qualities of the body. And so I'm just going to read this paragraph here and then. So it says, furthermore, just as if a sack or opening at both ends were full of various kinds of grain, wheat, rice, mung beans, kidney beans, sesame seeds, husked rice, and a man with good eyesight pouring it out were to reflect, this is wheat, this is rice, these are mung beans, these are kidney beans, these are sesame seeds, this is husked rice. In the same way, monks and nuns, a monk or nun reflects upon his or her own very body with the soles of his feet on up, from the crown of his head on down, surrounded by skin and full of various kinds of unclean things. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, tendons, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin oil, saliva, mucus, fluid in the joints and urine. Well, what's he doing here? I mean, one of the first statues I ever saw of the Buddha was when he was an ascetic monk before he realized the true path. And he was very, very thin. In fact, it's said that you could look at his front side and see his backbone sticking through his front, eating one grain of rice a day. This is mythology, of course, because no one can live on a single grain of rice a day. But nevertheless, there was a point in his practice when he was sort of trying to transcend the mind from the body. And even to this day, you'll find in some of the Southeast Asian countries some practices, like I had one teacher who encouraged his students to sit up even in the throes of malaria. I've had malaria, so I couldn't even stay conscious to the illness. So these kinds of very hardened mind resolves to get you through or over the body aren't very inviting to a welcoming vision of welcoming our attention into our body, which is really what this sutta is about. So what's the conflict here? How does this fit with the welcoming atmosphere that the first part of the sutta encourages? Well, the first thing was just the pragmatic quality of looking at the repulsive side is that it's an antidote to the attachment and the sexual desire that monks and nuns, if that's whom he was speaking with, have no recourse for. Monks and nuns are celibate completely. And yet that doesn't keep their mind from dwelling on fantasies like that. And so to offset or to counter the balance of influence of attractiveness, it's useful to look at the perceptions of the body as being unattractive, to see that it's not just this beautification Cosmopolitan magazine cover, that it contains some very repulsive qualities to it that are not very welcoming, and in fact you wouldn't buy the magazine if they were shown. We're asked to explore this body as it is, rather than what we would love it to be. And so you can see that the first reason then is a very practical reason. Let's just look at this thing, and since we've given it so much advantage, let's look at the disadvantage side of it, that it gets sick, that it is not always energetic, that it can be dull and lifeless, and look at that side, and then let it come back into a kind of a balance between the two. And so, fair enough. I think that he's not trying to negate the body as much as balance the energies of how we perceive the body. Now, he goes on, and he starts looking at the whole of the body. Instead of looking at the whole of the body, he starts breaking it into parts. And what looked so beautiful in its totality when it was all together, when we start looking at the individual parts of the body, breaking it into sections, doesn't hold that beauty so much, does it? It's like taking an automobile, you know, a very desirable automobile, and taking it apart, and then, you know, looking at the 32 parts of the automobile individually, you just lose the collective beauty of what it used to be. And so, too, we can take our attention into the body, and this actual reflection or contemplation or meditation on the 32 parts of body is actually a meditation, where you take your attention and you place it upon what I just read, and you begin just to feel that area of your body, and you just hold it instead of thinking, you just let it be, sit in your consciousness with you, and then you move to the next section and the next section, and it's it brings a quality of non-attachment to the body that can be very useful. And again, as Westerners, we are, if there's a leaning to us, the leaning is much more to the attractive side. So it does need to be balanced. It needs to be looked at. How are we going to be independent in of all things? That includes independence of our sense of infusing attachment to the body itself. It's going to die. In fact, the next couple of lectures on this series is going to be around death and dying, because that's where the next section of this sutta takes us. And so we'll be talking about death and dying. But to get a sense of that, and now let's look at some of the implied, the implications of that paragraph that I just read, because I think it's important. That what he is implying that we need to do is to change perceptions. We have a perceptual fix when we see a certain thing, and that's the only way that we see it. And how is it that we can change the perceptual fix that we're in? And so he wants to show us the relativity of perception. Mostly we invest in a kind of fixed perceptual way we look at the world. We have an emotional response to it, we have a narrative associated with it, and we don't want to see it any differently than the way we've invested in it. And what he is suggesting is that those perceptions, taken to be so true, are really just a particular perspective in the moment. And that if we can change them, you'll see a very different expression of life. It may not be pleasant because we have been focusing on the pleasant side, but if we look at just change one little ratchet down or over, suddenly it opens up into a very different experience. Now, perception needs to be looked at in terms of views and opinions, because once we have a perception, then very quickly a view starts coming in from that perception, and the views and opinions become very fixed within it. But we have fixed views and opinions that arise from relative perceptions. The perception that we see is only held fixed because of the view and intentionality of what we want to see. So if we want to see something beautiful, we will look just towards the beauty side of that. And so the perception will fix around that view and opinion. But if we release the view and opinion and really look at it from all different sides, it begins to show us the complete story. And that's very important, because fixed views come from relative perceptions. What do we know for certain? We seem to know everything, but everything we know is really just a perception that we have fixed a view and opinion around. And if we start looking from a different way, or allow our perceptions to move and float and be more liquid and less structured, then, and to release the view and opinion associated with them, then this whole thing gets wide open and very interesting. Now, part of the way that views and opinions are formed is the way that mind and physical body, mutually condition one another. So just listen to this, because this is implied within this sutta, is that mind conditions matter. Now, what do I mean by mind conditions matter? Well, if the mind is anxious, the body gets tense. Mind conditions matter, conditions the physical, doesn't it? So you can see that. You can get a sense of how the mental creates a tension or a result or has an effect on the physical quality of the body. So that's mind conditioning matter. How about matter conditioning mind? How does the body affect the mind? Well, it affects it if you're ill, if you have a physical ailment. That can make you dull and lifeless, have less energy, your mind is not as pliable, it's non-responsive. So that's the physical conditioning the mental. Okay? So now how does the mental condition the mental? First we've had the mental condition the physical, then we had the physical condition the mental. How does the mental condition the mental? Well, if we are outside, for instance, and we feel cold, that's a physical response. That coldness creates a mental aversion. That's a mental response to a physical cold. So that's the physical conditioning the mental. Now listen, from that sense of aversion, the mental response, comes another mental response in which I have decided a desire to go inside. So the mind that created the aversion now has its effect upon the mind's thought about where it would like to go to get out of that aversive response. So there we see the mind conditioning the mind. And finally, how does matter condition matter? Well, the food we eat affects the body, doesn't it? And so the certain foods you eat has a certain effect upon the body, and that's matter or body affecting body. So all of those different ways that matter and mind interconnect and condition one another begin to form the opinion and perception that we have about life as well. And you can begin to get a sense of it. You know, we think, what's wrong with my body today? And suddenly our mind is taking up a particular perspective within the body and then having an aversive response. And you can begin to see the interchange between the mind and the body as we begin to open up the display of what this thing is about, as we begin to investigate it. It becomes really fascinating to take it at that level of detail. So let's move on to the new implication, another thing that's implied within the sutta, and I want to spend a little bit of time on it because I gave you homework associated with it, and that is the emphasis on appearance as opposed to the awareness that holds the appearance. You know, our attraction to the body is based upon the appearance that we have invested in the body, not really the realization of what the body is. When you realize what the body is, you move beyond or deeper, you have a deeper relationship to the body than the simple appearance. Now, we keep our attention focused on appearance for a very good reason, that we don't want people to see the deeper sense of sorrow and unsatisfactoriness and suffering and pain that we are in that's just below the surface of that appearance. And so as long as I can look very pretty, you won't question me any deeper and to see what I am deeper than my appearance. So if I can hold your level of attention on my appearance, and if that fails, I have my personality. And now I hold your attention on the appearance of my personality. But for God's sakes, don't go any deeper than that. Because what we're afraid of is that people see the very pain that we're in. And ultimately, we're afraid of the emptiness, the sense of vacuity, the sense of being the vacuum itself that I spoke about earlier, that sense of being nothing. Deep down, we are nothing. And most of our defenses, when we start moving our sense of awareness into ourselves, is to protect ourselves from the discovery of that nothingness. And so we try to keep people's appearances or attention based upon our appearances, just as we try to keep our own attention based upon our appearances. How much time do we spend in front of the mirror as opposed to how much time do we sit on the floor in meditation? I think if we reversed that time, we would probably all be better meditators. And so that sense of appearance is really establishes the point of reference. It's with an appearance I can judge, I can compare, I can compete, I get I can get some traction to the sense of me, and I can live my life around and based from that sense of appearance. And that's 90% of our energy is really about appearances in this culture. It's having not just a car, but one that appears, you know, if you're a meditator, you want to drive a Prius. Right? But if you're a CEO, you don't care about a Prius. That's not your appearance reference. You know, so where we settle our attention very much is in accordance with the opinions and perceptions that we give to life at any particular time. So look at your appearances. See what they are. See where your intentions are for your life based upon your appearances. See how much we try to protect our appearance or keep them well shined and glossy so that people will stop at that door. See how much concern we give our sense of appearance to one another. Remember that deep inside of us is the vacuum of space itself, is the thing that is the common denominator to all species, to all things. And if we lose our footing and suddenly slip into that emptiness of space, that feels very jolting to us. And we prefer to have the rub of our life based upon something that we can master, that we can work upon, that we can accomplish, that we can improve, which is our sense of personality, our character, our appearance, whatever form of manifestation that we have settled upon. Now, another implication of this, just this very simple paragraph that I read, is are we being asked, this is a question, an implied question, are we being asked to love what is intrinsically repulsive? Because the Buddha says, I'll quote what the Buddha says, he says, you cannot experience the deathless, which means freedom, without access to the whole of the body, without the love of the whole of the body. And he's just given us sinews and hair follicles and urine and defecation and anuses and all. How are we to love that? The question is, how do we love that? And I think it's a very, very important question. Our love seems to be well suited for where it is that our appearances are resting, where it is that we have invested in our appearances. We can easily love the personality that's an easy personality. We can love the person who displays the kind of character that is spiritually appreciated, somebody who's generous. But if you go off scale, it gets harder and harder for us to find love, the range of our love, to meet some of our disapproving behaviors. And so our love is conditioned for most of us, conditioned upon what we think of and appreciate from life and what we want to invest in life being. And yet the Buddha is asking us to love unconditionally. And he's breaking down the body into areas that are very questionable about whether we can actually have any affection for these things. You know, I was thinking about giving you the homework of sending you out to a landfill and not to leave the landfill until you can abide in the landfill with a loving heart. Right? It's easy to go into the forest, go look at the virgin timbers and go up to Mount Rainier and look over the mountainside and your heart will spring forth, wasn't it? Because the appearance is so majestic and so beautiful. But what about the other side of life? What about the downtown seedy areas? What about the gas stations and the garbage and the landfills, et cetera, et cetera, you see? Is this love unconditional? Is it conditional? Is it conditioned upon appearances? Those are important questions that spring forth from this very simple passage here. And what we find is that as we learn to love what seems so impossible to love, like all areas of our body, loving, dare I say it, our anus. It's like, oh my God. You know, just having some sense of inclusivity and not sort of that is the repulsive side of me that I want no part of, but let's just small and he doesn't stop, you know, he just keeps taking you deeper and deeper into areas of their body that we really, please, not the hair follicles. And something really beautiful about his unswerving and determination to take us through the whole thing. And we have to be willing. So if you're have a very refined attention upon the breath, let's branch it out a little bit here. Let's begin to feel different parts of our body that hold a slight rub to us, and see if we can start including the whole of the body within that sense of attention. And what we'll find is that our sensitivity will increase. We'll have greater sensitivity the more inclusive we become. The more exclusive, the more we side with the appearances, then the more hardened our heart will be. Because it'll only spring forward when the right conditions are there, and everything else is sort of off the map in terms of what's respectable. So he's encouraging us. This is another way, through this sutta, he's encouraging us to be all-inclusive, unconditional in love. But he's taking us, he doesn't do this through, okay, everybody, now warm your heart, and now we're going to think of benefactors and friends, and now a little discouraging person, you know. No, he's taking us right into the guts and blood and pus of our body. He's doing it that way. He's doing it through that door, you see. Okay, so I want to read this final passage before we go tonight, because I want to get over this particular end so that we can get into the death and dying section of it next time. And this passage, he says, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Furthermore, just as a skilled butcher or his apprentice, having killed a cow, would sit at a crossroads cutting it into pieces, the monk or nun contemplates this very body. However it stands, however it is disposed, in terms of properties, in this body there is the earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, the wind property. Okay, so what is he talking about? Those the four elements are actually, if you get into the terminology and some meditation practices in Buddhist literature, there's the earth, the fire, the air, and the water element. That's how elements are perceived. So the fire element is the temperature quality of the body. Now, if you just as I speak, just notice the temperature quality of your body, whether it's hot or cold, or that's the fire element of the body. You see, we're just changing perceptions. You look at the body as you have known it to be. Now we're looking at it from a very different level of sensitivity, a different level of sensation. So the fire element is the process of temperature in the body. Sometimes it's rising, you know, as we get ill or whatever. Sometimes it feels very chilled and cold. The earth element. Earth element is the heaviness or hardness of the body, that sense of solidity of the body. And just now, as I speak, just see if you can't recover the sense of solidity in your body. Just feeling that sense of weight that's there. The air element is not actually associated with air itself, but in the movement of the body, the physical experience of movement, of things moving within the body, including the passage of air into the lungs. But in this sense, it would also be the blood in our veins moving as they do as well. So that sense of movement in the body is what's called the air element. And then finally, there is the water element, and that's the cohesion and extension part of the body. As the chest expands and stretches out, that sense of cohesion in the body. So just see if you can't feel that sense of cohesiveness in the body. So we're paying attention to our experience with a very different perceptual shift in it. And upon this, we can then look upon the body from that shift, which kind of breaks apart a different way of looking at it. If we're only fixed upon the appearance level, then this particular, these qualities of air and water, etc., shift us away from that a little bit and give us a very different way of perceiving the body. And again, when you shift perceptions, then you also, your opinions and views from which those perceptions were fixed upon start breaking apart. You can't hold the same views and opinions because they were based upon a particular perceptual fixation you were having. So change that fixation. Start looking at the body in terms of these elements, and it changes the nature of how you relate to it and your views about it. And it can be very helpful. It also increases our sensitivity and our subtlety and our receptivity to the body and its different aspects and its complete encouraged in its complete totality of what it is. So these are just ways to show us areas of way the mind clings and the way that we can change perception so that we can release some of the focused and attached ways that we see. Okay, so that's enough for tonight, and I thank you for your attention. Can we just sit for a minute or two? And just as we sit, let's just view the body, not from the usual perceptual way that we fix it, but let's perhaps bring forward a very different way of looking at it. We can move to areas of the body that we have up until this point sort of roped off. Or perhaps we can shift to one of the elements of the body, the fire element, just the temperature, feeling that aspect of bodiness. Or as the Goenka system does, the energy systems of the body, just the sense of energy in the body. And now just let us release the definitions entirely so that we're not held within a particular fixed perception of the body. What the Buddha says is to release the knowledge and memory of body. So that it's not called a certain thing by the mind. And certainly is not labeled as my body. And you can feel how it gets big as it escapes the definition. And how the intelligence of the body is most easily accessed without having definitions. It's somehow the perceptual shift we have within our definitions and the opinions we have within those descriptions somehow hold the intelligence of the body at bay. And don't allow an immediate access to the knowledge contained in the vacuum. So you really don't know when you want to touch the body's intelligence, you have to really not know. And then the intelligence manifests spontaneously through the body. We have been under the influence of that intelligence. We just keep breaking the signal with our own interference pattern, with our own mental story and narrative and opinion. The universe hasn't gone anywhere. We don't have to re-enter it. We just have to learn how we've obscured it. And this is where the Buddha was directing our attention. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. Yes, sir.
I don't find any of the things that the Buddha was describing as revolting or repulsive. So what use is it to define it as such?
Well, it's to balance energies for people who do find it. Because if you're not finding any of those things repulsive, if you don't find yourself being too attracted and too weighted in the attachment of the body, then this is, it's kind of a meaningless exercise for those who have balance there already, right? But it's always helpful to, I think, to break up what we think the body is in its totality to its individual pieces, to look and see what those individual things are that we have taken. And from that, a very different perception. It's like, you know, like taking it all apart and then trying to put it all back together, and somehow it doesn't fit back together quite as smoothly when you put it, doesn't mean the same thing once you've taken apart and then it comes back together. It doesn't come back as convincingly as a single thing when you have looked into each individual section of it and have really understood and seen it for what it was. So if it doesn't work for you on the repulsive side and persuasion, then try it from the butcher shop. Just cut yourself up and look at these. So what's the hand? What's the hand look feel like? What's the finger feel like? So what's the blood in the finger feeling? What's the skin on the finger feeling? So you can take it all apart. You don't have to go even very far. You can take it all apart from a single point on the body. It just helps kind of give it space, as we condense it down into being a certain thing. It's very much like the aggregates in Buddhism. The aggregates are the five areas that we claim to be a sense of me, consciousness and perception and body, etc. And if we don't look upon those things separately as being individuated references in themselves, then we take all the aggregates as an aggregate, as a me. In the same way, if we don't see the body as being more than just a single thing, we'll take it as a single thing that is me. But when you start feeling the different systems within the body and you start experiencing the different components within those systems, it just begins to provide a little space between that attached sense of I and my body. That's all. Anyone else? Yes.
How is the heart reacting in that moment? I'm thinking in consideration of the elemental values that you presented tonight, and thinking about them deeply in relation to the body, and wanting to know how the heart is reacting when we have a conscious experience with spaciousness.
How is the heart within a spaciousness, right? Well, in order for it to become spacious, in order for awareness to be spacious, it has to have unconditional love within that spaciousness, right? And you're not going to be spacious if some part of it you like and some part of it you don't like. You're going to be very narrowly gauged, aren't you, right? So to come to spaciousness is a full heart, right? So spaciousness and a full heart are really one and the same thing. So when awareness is not dwelling upon a particular idea or sensation as being troublesome or thought, right, when it can encompass the totality, nothing is upsetting it within that totality, right? And so that which holds the totality, right, you could say is love. Does that make sense to you? Okay, thank you all this evening. Appreciate it. We have some announcements that